Political campaigns have a capacity to generate a lot of conflict. Have you noticed? Especially this one. We expect conflict in the public arena, but when it spills into our friendships, into our families, into our church relationships, we always seem to be caught off guard. Last January, Marie and I were enjoying dinner in the home of some very dear Christian friends of ours. And we were having a sweet time of fellowship, and all of a sudden our host made an uncomplimentary remark about our president. And I said something in his defense. I said, you know, our president is really good when situations occur in our country, like the Boston Marathon bombings and the shootings in Charleston. He almost functions as the chaplain of the country. He says words of comfort and perspective that I found to be very consoling and strengthening. Now, I especially felt this way because our son was in Boston at the time of the Boston bombings. And so I thought I was just making a observation. I wasn't endorsing him. I wasn't saying I would vote for him. I was just making a statement. She stood up and said, "He's evil, 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 evil." Now, whenever I feel someone is trying to convert me to their point of view, no matter what my point of view is, there's something in me that rises in defense. And the conflict just started to, I said some things and she said some things. I thought she was going to cast demons out of me. And if she wasn't going to cast demons out of me, she was going to cast me out of the house. It was very distressing. Like, what happened here? And I know what some of you are thinking. Well, he is evil, of course. Don't you know that? And already you're grinding your teeth and you're thinking, I got to have a talk with Steve after the service today. And be prepared, because I'm going to be a little defensive and resistant to what you have to say. And it has nothing to do with my political views at all. In this campaign, I seem to be bombarded on both sides by those who are claiming that God seems to be endorsing one candidate over the other candidate. I'm reminded of a story about Yogi Berra, the Hall of Fame catcher for the New York Yankees. Yogi Berra was behind the plate in one game, and opposing batter steps into the batter's box and makes the sign of the cross with his bat on home plate. And Yogi, who was a very devout Catholic, calls, "Time out!" And he gets up and he wipes the plate clean with his catcher's mitt. And he looks up at the batter and says, "Why don't we just let God watch the game?" Sometimes I feel that way. Let's just let him watch. And other times I'm desperately crying out, "Lord, show us what to do. Show us how to view things. Help us here." Yes, we expect conflict in the public realm, but when it creeps into our intimate relationships, it's very distressing. Psalm 133 says, "Behold how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell together in unity." And if that is so, surely, behold how bad and unpleasant it is when brothers dwell together in disunity. There's a popular Hebrew song based on this psalm. Perhaps you're familiar with it. The chorus goes, "In unity to dwell in unity. Ay, 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 ay." If we just change the lyrics, "In disunity to dwell in disunity. Ay, 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 ay." We don't want conflict in our families. We don't want conflict in our marriage. We don't want conflict in our neighborhoods. And we certainly don't want conflict in our church. And yet, there it is. I have been a Christian for over 40 years, and I've been in a lot of churches, and I've pastored a lot of churches, and I haven't found a single church yet that had no conflict. I think conflict is a part of life, and conflict is a part of church life. We have to understand that and accept that and yet live responsibly with the light and grace that God gives. Now, the psalm, "Behold how good and pleasant it is for brothers to dwell together in unity," says there's two great blessings that come when we do that. One is it's like precious oil from the head coming down from the beard, even Aaron's beard. You always knew when Aaron the high priest was in the neighborhood, you could smell him. The oil was just dripping from the guy. And yet oil was a symbol of the presence and favor and blessing of God. It is a symbol of the Holy Spirit. When God's people dwell together in unity, there is oil that is dripping in that situation that is a fragrant aroma that draws people to Christ. And then the psalmist says, it is like the dew of Mount Hermon coming down upon the mountains of Zion, for there the Lord commanded the blessing, life forevermore. It is like oil, and it is like dew. Dew is refreshing, renewing, and restoring. It is a symbol of blessing. Where God's people are living together in unity, there the Lord sends blessing by His command. Unity and blessing come from above. I don't know if you noticed the little phrase repeated three times, coming down, coming down, coming down. When we're dwelling together in unity, there's grace and blessing like oil and like dew coming down from heaven, bringing refreshment and healing, encouragement. Now, unity and blessing come from above. They are divine gifts, but it is our responsibility to preserve the unity that is given. Now, that is clearly taught in Ephesians 4, 1 through 6. And I'm going to read this passage, and this is one that we all should memorize. "I, therefore, the prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love." And here's the key verse: "eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." We must maintain the unity, and we must be ever vigilant in doing that. Now we have to be thinking, what are the things that we do or say to keep the blessings of precious oil and dew coming to our church? Romans 12:18 says, "If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men." Now last week, we learned that a serious controversy threatened to shatter the unity of the early church. Wisdom was needed to resolve the issue. The result was that the early church was strengthened and encouraged. I want to springboard from something that Jeff said that made a lot of sense to me. He said, "The missing piece when there is controversy and conflict in the church, the missing piece is not intelligence. What we need is wisdom with humility and grace." And he mentioned that wisdom has sort of a texture to it. It has the ability to unify, to bless, to bring peace, even when there is disagreement, even when there is conflict, even when there are strong feelings. Wisdom begins with the ability to say, I don't have it all figured out. Now, our son graduated from UMass Boston in June. We were so pleased to be able to attend his commencement service, a six-hour commencement service held in the Boston Garden. We left after 3 hours. Unbelievable. But when you've got thousands of graduates, what can you do? And the speakers went on and on and on. The commencement speaker was a new congressman from the Boston area. I can't remember his name, but he spoke for 10 minutes. And I thought, wow, I want to find out more about this guy. And what he said is, he was a first-term congressman, and he said, you know, I've learned that there are a lot of very smart people in Congress, but not very many wise people in Congress, and not many who have courage to act on the wisdom that they have. And that was his appeal to the graduating students. Intelligence, yes, that's important. Wisdom, that's important, but courage is also needed. And what we're going to see is that great courage is needed, and great wisdom is needed, and great grace is needed whenever we encounter conflict in the church. Now, in his speech at the Jerusalem Council, Peter enunciated a great principle. And that was that we should find the direction in which God is moving and then fall in line. That is always a good policy. We open our eyes and our ears and we ask, Lord, what are you doing? And when we know what that is, we follow what he's doing, even if it's unfamiliar, even if it's new, even if it's uncomfortable. Now, Peter reviewed God's ministries to the Gentiles in the past, said that's what God was doing in the past. Paul and Barnabas reported on God's work among the Gentiles in the present. That's what God's doing now. And James was the final speaker, and he focused on what God was doing in the future. Now, Paul and Barnabas played a prominent role in the council. They brought great wisdom to bear on the controversy. And in Acts 14:27, God is said to have worked with Barnabas and Paul. When they had arrived and gathered the church together, they began to report all the things that God had done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. In their relationship with each other, this was one of the great teams of early church history. Barnabas was a man who had helped young Paul get established in the Christian faith. And in the book of Acts, in the early chapters, it's always Barnabas and Paul, Barnabas and Paul. And at a certain point, it becomes Paul and Barnabas and Paul and Barnabas. And Paul kind of merges into the prominent role, and Barnabas retreats into the background. But God was with them, and when God is with us, his favor is upon us, his presence is with us, and what happens? Doors open. But in Acts 15:12, Luke says that what God not only worked with them, he worked through them. There's nothing more exciting than the sense that God is with you, but even more exciting is the sense that God is working through you. Verse 12, all the people kept silent, and they were listening to Barnabas and Paul as they were relating what signs and wonders God had done through them among the Gentiles. Very interesting. With them and through them. With them and through them. But in Acts 15:36, something has changed. And after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are. You see, they had a sense of what God was doing, and they were going to align themselves with that sense. A good purpose, a good goal. Verse 37, now Barnabas wanted to take with them John called Mark, later to become the author of the Gospel of Mark. But Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And this is a reference to an incident that occurred back in Acts chapter 13, where Mark, for reasons unknown, quit. He was a part of the team, and then he just decided, I'm done, I'm out of here, and he went home. No explanation is given. Was it a problem with lack of conviction? We don't know. A lack of commitment? We don't know. But in Paul's mind, he was a quitter. And Paul does not want quitters on his team. As we would say today, he was a loser. He doesn't want losers on his team. He wants people who can function at a high capacity. And so now there is, verse 39, there arose a sharp disagreement. Now, that's a translation of a Greek word that means really heated argument. Formerly, Barnabas and Paul were side by side, linked together. God was with them, and because God was with them, God was working through them. But now this had become this. How does that happen between close friends? There arose a sharp disagreement. The grammar of the verbs here suggests that the disagreement went on for some time. In other words, it was a long and intense and heated argument. In my mind's eye, I can see Paul and Barnabas. Barnabas formerly being Paul's mentor. And there they are, nose to nose, their faces getting red, their hands clenched. And off to the side is Mark, listening to this and knowing that all of the conflict is because of him. The disagreement was so sharp between these colleagues and friends so that they separated from each other. Now, the picture here is of Paul and Barnabas just saying, you know what? We are both entrenched in our positions. Barnabas wanted to take Mark on the team. Mark was Barnabas's cousin. Barnabas knew that, yes, Mark had failed. He had quit. But he saw potential in Mark. And he felt that he deserved a second chance. Paul said, no way. I don't want that guy on my team. And so they separated. I kind of imagine Paul walking down to the wharf with Barnabas and Mark. They got on a ship, sailed to the island of Cyprus, which was where Barnabas was from. I can imagine Paul waving goodbye as the ship disappears over the horizon. And Barnabas sails right out of the book of Acts, never mentioned again. And it ends on this note. How sad, how tragic. And Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord, and went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Formerly there was one team, the dream team, now separated, and now there are two teams going in two different directions. What happens when an irresistible force meets an immovable object? What happens when two good men, two godly men, are equally convinced that quite opposite courses should be taken? This is not a conflict over doctrine. This is not a conflict over goals. This is a conflict over means to achieve a goal, namely the composition of the team. And so a heated discussion took place, and in the end, neither one would budge. And so Paul and Barnabas agreed on the importance of this trip. but they could not agree on the composition of the team. And here we have two dedicated men who had just helped bring unity to the church, and yet they could not settle their own disagreements. Disturbing and painful as these conflicts are, they are found throughout church history, and yet God is able to overrule them and accomplish his purposes. Now, my first connection with this church was in 1967 when my sister invited me to church. And so I have a long connection and association with this church. And we seem to be in a season of well-being and unity right now, even though we embrace the value of diversity in our church. But it hasn't always been that way. There has been a lot of conflict. And yet here we are today. And the oil is flowing and the dew is still coming. But it is our responsibility to maintain the unity of the faith. Now, I think there are some things that we learn about conflict in this passage. And one is that we accept the fact that conflict is going to be a normal part of church life, even between good friends. It doesn't mean that we look for controversy. It doesn't mean that we're stirring up controversy, although every one of us has a capacity to do that if we're careless with what we say, if we're careless with what we do. But it is going to be a part of our church life. Now, we don't like conflict in our marriages. We know how unpleasant that is. We don't like conflict in our families. We know how unpleasant that is. And we like conflict even less in the church. And yet God gives us direction here how to manage the conflict and make the most of it rather than allow it to drive us apart. Secondly, we identify the issue, the area of concern, and we ask ourselves, what was Paul's concern? And he might be accused of being very task-oriented here, less interested in the team and more interested in getting the job done. And yet that is a legitimate concern because he had this sense of God-given responsibility for the churches that had grown up in the Gentile areas. He didn't want someone who he would have to hold his hand or always be nudging him to get him in the game. He wanted a team that was up and running and fully functioning. And what was Barnabas's concern? He might be faulted for being more concerned for the people than he was for the job that needed to be done, and yet both of those concerns are legitimate. Mark was his cousin, and Barnabas saw potential in Mark, and he's recognized that Mark needed some help in doing and becoming the man of God that God wanted him to be. When I was courting Marie, her parents had died. And so I went to her pastor, who was functioning in kind of a surrogate parent role, and I asked him for his blessing to move forward in my relationship with Marie. And he was quiet for a while. We were sitting in his car in front of his house in Costa Mesa, and he says, "This may be like taking a bazooka to your brain." Now, I didn't quite know what he meant by that, but I knew that couldn't be good. Sally, you know this person, so you can well understand. And then he explained what he meant by that, and he said, "But I'm willing to help you to become the man that you need to become in order for this marriage to work." Barnabas was that kind of a guy. What was Mark's concern? Oh, Mark had failed. Mark now had the loser label on him. Mark needed someone to believe in him more than he believed in himself. So we identify the issue, the area of concern. Thirdly, we clarify the needs and goals of the other parties in the conflict. Now, I have found that sometimes I have difficulty understanding another person's point of view because I'm trying so hard to convert them to my point of view. I think we need to first seek to deepen our understanding of the other person's needs and concerns. I've learned that in most conflicts are over unmet needs or unfulfilled expectations. In order to resolve the conflict, we have to find out what those needs are and what those expectations are. And we ought not to blame, criticize, or attack, but listen to understand those needs. Now, my need is usually that my voice is heard and valued, even if you disagree with me. And finally, we search for alternatives that enable all parties to achieve as many of their goals as possible. Some years ago, our dear pastor, Brad Coleman, informed us all that he was leaving and taking a new position in Chicago. I've known Brad long before he became the pastor of this church. He was pastor here for 13 years during a very important transitionary period of the life of the church. God used Brad greatly to bring unity and peace and health to our church. And when Brad informed me that he had this possibility of going back to Chicago, he asked my opinion, and I said, wow, if they ask you, I think that's a pretty hard position to pass up. That's a once-in-a-lifetime door that is opening. When I said that, I didn't think that he would take me seriously. I was sort of stunned when he took the position. And we were very dear and close friends, and I went through a grieving process. I remember the elder board meeting in which Brad asked the question, how and when do we inform the congregation that I'm leaving? And then he paused and says, and do we at the same time inform the congregation that Jeff is now the lead pastor? Now, I've asked Jeff's permission to share this story. This is kind of pulling back the veil a little bit to see some of the drama that goes behind some of our elder board meetings. If you read the minutes of the elder board meeting, you would have no clue whatsoever that there was any drama at all. But so here's Brad informing us, and now I speak up and I say, well, wait a minute. We haven't even talked or prayed about who will replace you. And I realized it was awkward, but I thought that it was inappropriate for Brad to make those two decisions one and the same. And apparently I was a little intense in my expressing my feelings. But I didn't really know what my feelings were. It was nothing against Jeff. It was just I was taken off guard. Gary Smith, who is a very dear friend of mine, stood up and said, I am offended. And I thought he was going to invite me to go in the alley to resolve this out there in the alley. And he's a former football player for the UCLA Bruins, and I didn't think I was going to come out on the top of that. It was awkward, it was intense, and yet I was feeling something, but I didn't know what, and it must have been very awkward for Jeff, who was there. And now we're arguing over, was Jeff the guy or isn't he the guy? And, oh, it was a dangerous moment in the life of the church. I went home and I had to identify what my feelings were, what the issue was, and what are the alternatives here. And I asked God for wisdom. In my experience, when I ask God for wisdom, and it comes immediately, there's urgency. It's almost like God is saying, I don't want you to waste a single minute going down the wrong trail here. And here's what I heard from God as clear as a bell. Stop keeping Jeff small. What? Is that what I'm doing? How am I doing that? on the emotional level, I was grieving that Brad was leaving. And I didn't, I'm a man. I don't know how to label feelings. Marie is always asking me, what are you thinking? And half the time, I'm thinking, I wonder if the Cubs won today. Geez, my roses are looking horrible out there. I'm not thinking about anything, really. But when she asks me, well, what are you feeling? I have no clue how to answer that question. But in conflict, our feelings are real and our feelings are to be valued. When people are in conflict with me, I've come to recognize that it's important for me to understand their feelings and validate their feelings. It's not a matter of agreeing or disagreeing with their point of view. It is just understanding where they're coming from, but also understanding where I'm coming from. But with that simple stop keeping Jeff small, I had a sense of the direction that God was moving in, and now I need to get in line with that and support that. There's an addendum to this story. Some months later, Brad had left. We had that wonderful send-off for him. Jeff was now the lead pastor. The elder board was meeting in the upper room. And one evening, we had some people come in who needed prayer for healing or other issues. And all the elders gathered around, as we customarily do, and began to pray for him. And that particular night, I was in a funk. I was just not there. Have you ever been here but not there? Yeah. Have any of you even once looked at your cell phone during this sermon, wondering how long this message is going to last? And when am I going to be able to get back in touch with this person who's texting me? Well, I was in one of those moods, and I had retreated the sidelines, and I was kind of, I'm here, and I'm praying, but I'm just not in the huddle. And Jeff looks at me in the corner and says, "Steve, stop being small." And it was kind of like, whoa, yeah. And he pulls me back into the circle, and it was his way of saying, you're needed here. You are a valued member of this team. Don't check out. And so, yes, we should stop keeping Jeff small. And yes, Steve, you need to stop keeping yourself small. And we move forward with the blessing and favor of God, confident that each one of us has value, each one of us has voice, each one of us has a capacity to be wrong, each of us has the capacity to be right, and each of us has the capacity to either spread oil and dew or to restrain it. And so my encouragement to you is that let's take seriously the admonition in Scripture to be diligent to preserve the unity of faith. Because the world is watching, and we need that blessing of oil and dew to flow out of this room and into the streets of Laguna Beach, all the way to Bangkok, and all the way to Oaxaca, and all the way to Malawi, and everywhere in the world where the ministry of this church will be a blessing because He is with us and He wants to work through us.